Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us now is United States Air Force Lieutenant General Greg Guillot, the commander of U.S. Air Force's Central Command at Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar, as well as the legendary 9th Air Force headquartered at Shaw Air Force Base in South Carolina. In fact, they are one and the same. AFCENT has about 13,000 personnel across the theater and 1,000 based at Shaw. Sir, thanks so very much for joining us. It's an honor to have you on.
Well, thank you very much. The pleasure is all mine.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Sir, obviously the coronavirus pandemic has impacted the entire planet. Your forces don't have the option of falling offline because it is a 24/7 real-time mission across 27 nations and supporting coalition and allied partners, all the way from Afghanistan on south. What are some of the changes that you've made during the course of this pandemic that you're going to be continuing after the pandemic lifts, right? Better ways of doing business. The chief has encouraged accelerating change. What are some of the changes that you've made during COVID that are going to be lasting?
The relationship with our partner nations is so important, and it's hard to build a relationship when you can't go visit them. And that's where we've been for the past year. But I've become a texter, and then so I'm finding that I can text with the various air chiefs of the different nations over here and really establish a good rapport with them, and top that off with the occasional VTC and phone calls instead of, you know, flying to see face-to-face. And I really look forward to seeing more of them face-to-face to cement the relationships. But I think the ability to do some quick hits and talks and texts with our partners has really helped us instead of saving up a whole bunch of things for, you know, a face-to-face meeting. So I think that will be something that I'll try to continue even after the vaccines, are in everybody's arms and we can start going without the mask and relaxing some of the restrictions that we've had, which again, I hope is soon. We're getting some vaccines over here and our partners are too. And so we're hopeful, just like everybody else is, that we're starting to see the end of this.
It is really interesting how what is a global tragedy can actually benefit interoperability and actually real world operations going forward. And I want to talk about that in a moment in greater detail with you, given so many really exciting things are going on. Israel obviously is part of your AOR now, Abraham Accords, and obviously bringing together a fourth and fifth generation air power. But one of the persistent challenges in the region is Iran. It has operated very effectively through proxy states or proxy organizations. Iranian militia is thought to have attacked Al-Asad Air Base again in the wake of the strike the United States executed to punish an Iranian-backed militia that launched missiles that killed a contractor a couple of weeks ago. Israeli officials say that a Libyan tanker may have released oil on purpose to contaminate Israeli beaches. And obviously tensions are running high between Tehran and the rest of the world over international inspections of all of its nuclear facilities. Tehran has pushed back against all of those facilities being opened up and rejected talks. From your standpoint, sir, have you seen a change in Iranian posture in the region in terms of its conventional military forces, that it also tends to flex its muscles sometimes when international negotiations are ongoing?
Well, I think the important thing to start with is the fact that we're not looking to escalate this. You know, we don't want war with Iran, but we do want to make sure that we're postured to defend for stability in the region, defend the partners, and be ready for any contingency. What I see day to day out of Iran is not significantly different. You mentioned a lot of the challenges that we see with the proxy groups, and you mentioned the recent attacks that forced us to respond on the 26th of February. I would just say that we watch very closely, And, you know, we'll always be postured to defend and respond if needed. And one of our absent priorities is to try to deter the regional adversaries by showing that not only do we have a presence, but we also have a bunch of partners that we're well integrated with and we interoperate with very well. And we set up a formidable defense.
As a general rule, we seem with the Iranians to be in this sort of tit for tat. Is that pretty much what life is going to be like? I mean, are there better ways from your standpoint to deter their behavior? Or is the fact that something big isn't happening effectively deterrence? I mean, what's your sense on that as somebody who's got experience in the region?
The approach we try to take, Pago, is instead of letting them drive and dictate and we react to everything, I try to present a steady dosage of capability that can serve as a deterrent to let them and any other adversary that would come into the region to disrupt the peace and the stability. Let them see that we have a lot of capability, we have partners, and that we not only can respond, but we will respond if needed. And so the way we do that, there's a way of employing forces that we call dynamic force employments. And these are deliberately planned to occur on a very short timeline. And it can be for us, aircraft mostly, but bomber aircraft, fighter aircraft can come over. They can show up when needed, kind of a just in time, not just in case, and work with partners, work with the forces that we already have over here to augment and increase the capability. And we've had a couple of these since December. We had one from Spangdahlem Air Base, Germany, which were some F-16s. And then from Seymour Johnson Air Force Base, North Carolina, which were some F-15E Strike Eagles that came over here. They did a lot of work. It shows our ability to rapidly respond to anything. And then the nice thing is they get great training. And when they go back to their respective bases, they return with more readiness at the high end than they had when they came to the theater. Another thing that we do is an Air Force concept called Agile Combat Employment. And there we use, we emphasize elements of air power that are very unique, that are flexible and agile, and allows us to move quickly throughout the theater. As you know, we're one air component that really responds to four different parts of the region. And so we can move aircraft across very quickly that could affect operations in one area and take a small debt, move them to a different base, operate very effectively out of a base other than their home base, and affect a different part of the area. So we call that Agile Combat Employment. PACAF and USAFE do it as well. Theirs is, you know, maybe a little bit different than ours because their geography is different and the atmosphere is different, the threat atmosphere. But I think we're about 60 to 70% common in our ACE characteristics. And so we've been really doing a lot of that lately. You've probably seen the Bomber Task Force missions, and those demonstrate our ability to rapidly bring a lot of firepower anywhere in the world to support the security and stability goals. And we do a lot of training with them. And then that also assures our partners. So it's a deterrence measure, but it's also an assurance. It's great to see them when they come over. You've probably seen pictures where our partners will escort the B-52s or B-1s through the region. And I think that sets a very powerful message, not only to potential adversaries in a form of deterrence, but it also assures everybody, you know, on the partner side, that how committed we are to the region and to stability there. Our forces then return for perhaps deployment to another region with a higher level of readiness.
Key to deterrence not only is U.S. capability in the region, but also how closely we work with allies and partners. And as you noted during COVID, you've actually expanded and deepened that cooperation. Iran is a common challenge. And now Israel is part of the CENTCOM area of responsibility. And we also have the Abraham Accords, which is a warming of relations between Israel and a number of Gulf nations, including and most importantly, the United Arab Emirates. The Saudis and the Israelis have had a relationship that's been somewhat more under the table for many years, again, driven by their common concern about Iran and its regional proxy forces, but as well as its capabilities just on the other side of the Gulf. How has Israel joining the AFCENT AOR or the CENTCOM AOR and the Abraham Accords changed the dynamic training environment? Because now you have another nation that's a fifth generation Air Force that is going to be able to operate in the region with the United States, which is a fifth generation Air Force. United Kingdom will have its assets in the region, whether in the form of the Royal Air Force or the Royal Navy and Queen Elizabeth and Prince of Wales. And the United Arab Emirates may be an F-35 nation. How have all of these circumstance come together to change how you're going to be training, working interoperability issues, and being able to improve overall the deterrent posture in the region?
There's going to be changes, but really, Israel has been and will continue to be a close partner to AFCENT in the region. I don't know if you know this, but for years, we've routinely partnered with the Israeli Air Force, as you just alluded to, often with the F-35's integrations. We've had exercises where we had Israeli, U.S., and Royal Air Force F-35s operating together. And we try to, you know, on a semi-regular basis, do what we call enduring lightning, which would be our F-35 lightnings with the Israelis. So we worked together for a long time. Obviously, a lot of mutual respect between the air forces for the capabilities of the other. In fact, I just recently flew to Israel and had a very successful visit with the Israeli Air Force with Major General Norkin, who's their Air Force commander. I got to fly with him, and we also discussed fifth generation aircraft and the impact on the theater of operations. And he mentioned many of the things that you just did, which is, you know, the potential growth of the F-35 in the region and how we can work together. I think the benefit to this, not only at a military level, is, you know, it shows the like-mindedness of Israel and a number of Arab states that the greatest threat that we all face to regional security could be Iranian malign activity. And so with a common concern there, I think it just increases more opportunities for cooperation. And you get that cooperation by training together and working together. And with that, you know, it breaks down more walls. And I think you refer to my previous answer about the importance of the deterrence, showing this friendship and this partnership that we have with so many countries across the region. And this is great to add Israel to that list.
Obviously, having nations that are coming together in terms of being able to project fifth generation capabilities is important, but it's equally important to integrate those fifth generation assets with fourth generation assets, which is what you find across the theater, whether in the form of American aircraft like the F-15 and the F-16, or the Eurofighter or the Rafale. An aircraft operated by Qatari forces or going to be operated by Qatari forces as well. During the Manama Air Power Symposium, I moderated a panel discussion that talked about the integration of fourth and fifth generation air power. How is that going in terms of making sure that you have a force that is as seamless and interoperable as future? You're an air battle manager by trade and training. So often that burden falls to guys like you in the back of an airplane, fat fingering your way through it, as opposed to having that kind of seamless integration that we want to see ultimately, right? I mean, we're seeing that with our Japanese allies. We're not as close as we should be, and obviously concern about China is driving us to get closer. How would you rate where you are and where you got to be in terms of integrating all of these assets?
Well, fifth to fifth gen, I think that we're doing well. We don't have as many opportunities to do it as we'd probably like, but we've had great integration with the Royal Air Force and with the Israeli Air Forces, as we just talked about. And then when I say we, you know, a lot of times we think Air Force, but of course, you know, we've had Marine Corps F-35s in the theater, and you know, that brings terrific capability and opportunities to work on that fit-to-fit integration. But to your point, what we'll see for years to come, well, how do we integrate fifth to fourth and use the combined capabilities to the best effect? That's where I think we've really made a lot of ground over the last few years, knowing where and when we might need some of the great fusion capability that you have with the fifth generation, or where you might need the low observable capability, versus when you might need more weapons or specific type of weapons, which might only be available in the fourth gen. We've made a lot of progress there. Those DFEs have helped us in that regard, the DFEs that I mentioned a moment ago. And then, one of the things that I talked to General Norkin in Israel about was not just how do we get our F-35s together, but how do we, they have some great fourth gen capability as well. How do we get our fourth gen working together? And then how do we do a fifth to fourth with them? And that's something that I think you'll see more and more. Another thing that we talked about during your Manama symposium was also bringing in RPAs and UAVs into that as well, how they can feed that. Those are things that we're working on all the time. We have what are called WEPTACs, Weapons and Tactics Conferences, twice a year, where we bring the experts in, talk about how well we've done that, and then codify and incorporate those into our standard operating procedures once we're sure that they're working well. And then we also, ship those ideas and those processes back to Nellis, where they can be distributed across the Air Force and used in other theaters as well. And you're right. On the AWACS, I was definitely known for being a fat fingers, and the machine-to-machine is much faster. It's more precise. The list of benefits to that just goes on and on. The more we can get away from speaking over voice, passing coordinates, and writing them down and using machines to do it, the better at that we are, the better our results will be. And then what we get with a lot of these aircraft now is, if you just point, get the information that you want to pass, and then and get it through the link to others, whether they're fifth or fourth gen, and we're able to do that more and more effectively all the time.
And obviously we've seen a focus in my conversations with air chiefs in the region, right? Getting that fourth generation air power to a point, whether it's older F-16s or newer Eurofighters or F-15s or anything else, into that environment where we can have that seamless interoperability. The Bahraini air chief spoke with some thoughtfulness on, how he's investing in order to bring his air force up to speed, for example, to be able to do that. Our time is short, and I've got three questions. One, United States is assessing its global force posture. Obviously, we'll see what's going to be next, but the interim national security strategy talked about ending forever wars. That suggests that the incoming administration is likely going to reduce the troop presence, whether it's in Iraq or in Afghanistan. From an enduring standpoint, though, what are the recommendations you're putting in? Because, whether they're called AFCENT or CENTAF, and I should say, right, conjoining the two is a blast from the past, right? Because CENTAF leaders used to be Ninth Air Force as well as the job. And for a while, it became a dedicated job. And now we've melded them back again. At the end of the day, what is the enduring air power presence in the theater, irrespective of what the troop on the, what the boots on the ground component of the equation is?
We'll always need an air presence over here for a number of reasons. And I think if I kind of talk you through our, my main priorities, you'll see how that plays out. So the first one would be, fight to win today. And we're executing, I think, a mission that's of national, regional, and global importance. We're in named operations, Operation Inherent Resolve and Resolute Support mission, and we have to be able to win today. And of course, air power is a very important part of doing that. But at the same time, we need to deter regional aggressors. Now, the airplanes that are doing those missions and while they conduct those missions, I think that has a deterrence value in itself. Anybody who would possibly want to be an aggressor to the U.S. or coalition can see on a daily basis what we're doing with air power as we fight in those named operations, and know that it could be applied to respond to any of their malign activity if needed. But the other part of deterring there is we need to posture to prevail tomorrow. So the types of fights that we have today in OIR and RSM that I just mentioned aren't necessarily the same that we would use in other parts of the region if needed to. The threat's different, the terrain's different, et cetera. So we have to have the capability over here with the air power that we have to train. Some of that's the agile combat employment that I mentioned earlier, the ability to bring in the forces of the DFE, and then, you know, practice deliveries and tactics and techniques that we might need on short notice if we were called and deterrence failed and response was necessary. So between those three, you know, fighting to win today, deterring aggressors, and posture to prevail tomorrow if the deterrence fails, are three of the priorities that I have. And I think you can see that a level of air power is required for all of those. But there's another aspect of this. We can't do any of those three without partners, as I've mentioned several times throughout this. So for my fourth priority is to forge resolute partnerships. Normally that we're talking about the partner nations there, but that's also partnerships with the joint force, so the Navy component and the Marines. Certainly the Army, working with them, partnerships with other combatant commands, as for instance, on the Bomber Task Force, as Strategic Command sends them over. We're always working to forge these partnerships, but certainly in the region, you have to do that with a presence in the air, as we talked about earlier, you know, by VTC, but hopefully soon when COVID is finally defeated and eradicated from the region, we can do it in the form of face-to-face exercises. You know, I also have, I think, a very important priority of embracing equality, and my point there, I think that is a foundational to these other priorities that I mentioned, and just making sure that every airman and absent knows what an important job that they have, and that they're an equally important member of this command, and their contributions are equally valued, regardless of who they are. And I think I need to show them that we have a command where they can be that person without any roadblock or hindrance, you know, institutional or cultural, that keeps them from progressing to the level that they want to achieve through their own hard work and talent. And so that's the embrace equality priority, which I think underpins all of those. Fighting to win today, deterring regional aggression, posture to prevail tomorrow, and then forging the partnerships. All of those require a level of aircraft. I can't tell you a certain number, but right now we have the right amount to be able to do all of those.
We have two very quick questions I'd like to get your take on. First, last time I was at LUD, obviously your Qatari hosts were putting a lot of investment in improving capabilities. And like every forward commander, you also have modernization priorities. What are some of your top equipment priorities for your command? And how is the Qatari investment moving the needle in terms of improving your ability to project capability throughout the region?
Qatar is a... They're great hosts. They're great partners in the air. They're great partners on the ground. You mentioned a few minutes ago the Rafale. I got to fly in a Rafale yesterday or day before yesterday with them, and they're a fantastic Air Force, very modern and very focused on the same things that we are. As far as a host here on the base, they're putting a lot of attention and money into improving facilities. And, you know, they tell me frequently that they want us to think of Qatar as their home away from home. Their actions show it. So It's a pleasure to be over here working with them. But I have to say that the same goes for all of our regional partners. You know, the relations are strong. They're all very welcoming. They're great to work with. I don't have any specific requirements from any of them that aren't being met. What I look for is to have facilities or places we can operate from safely. And we certainly have that. And then we want to be with them like-minded, you know, in terms of our mission. And we certainly have that all across the AOR.
And modernization from back home, what are you asking the chief for in terms of resources to be better able to execute your mission? And I have one last follow-up question.
General Brown made it really clear that we need to accelerate change or risk losing. We just have a very open dialogue on the capabilities that we need. We're very involved in talking about JADC2 and what that would mean over here as, you know, perhaps the only, you know, kinetic fight going on at this time. I think that we have some really good perspective how we would employ JADC2. And so we have a lot of conversations on that. We have some really sharp experts that are on the various working groups and panels that are informing how that capability will come to the in the future. So I think that that's our biggest modernization requirement. And then we look at modernization efforts that are going on with aircraft, whether they're you know, new systems or improvements to existing systems, and constantly looking at how we would integrate them into our various plans. You know, when they get over here, doing what I already spoke to you about is you know, operating with the partners and validating those tactics and techniques and procedures that we would use, you know, that we've incorporated into the plans and making sure that we can do them quickly if needed.
And last question. China has been very, very aggressive in expanding all around the world. Certainly, we hear that in Europe and European officials. And on my visits to the Gulf, I've noticed that the Chinese footprint is growing. How is that changing the dynamic in the region as China gets closer to traditional allies? Some have purchased Chinese equipment, which has caused a little bit of a challenge. How is China's introduction to the region changing the dynamic from your standpoint?
As the air component, I haven't seen it too much. I know in the region that there's certainly a an economic impact that China's trying to have in the region with some of our partners. And as you mentioned, they're trying to sell equipment, you know, throughout the region. I think that the ability to interoperate with us will always be an advantage. And the fact that for years they've purchased Western or namely U.S. capabilities. And, you know, with that comes training opportunities and sustainment and development of new tactics, techniques, and procedures over the years. And I think our partners recognize that. So I haven't seen from my vantage point, I've certainly seen the influence of the great power competition, you know, Russia, China, in the theater. But in the air component, particular to the PRC, I haven't seen too much of it.
Sir, thanks so very much. Really appreciate you spending as much time with us. Look forward to seeing you either here or over there or in sunny South Carolina when the opportunity next presents it. Thanks very much. All the best to you and your team. Stay well and look forward to talking again soon. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. And look forward to seeing you at any of those places as soon as we can.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.